my pleasure to welcome you here to the Clark Howard Show, where our mission is to serve you with advice and information that empowers you so you make better financial decisions in your life. And I hope one of those decisions you'll make is to subscribe to our free daily newsletter at clark.com/newsletter. You're going to get so much information that empowers you and fattens that wallet of yours. Today, auto theft has been such a bad, ugly thing. Oh man, I heard a story on an airplane just last week from a gentleman whose brand new car was stolen out of a parking lot right after he'd walked away. So I've got an easy, cheap fix for you that will help prevent this. Also, I have some key warnings for you if you're looking for a remote job, as unfortunately, we're hearing a lot of job seekers that are getting ripped off when they're looking for work. So this one is news of the weird. You park your car, and most often this is happening at home at night. You park your car not in a garage. Maybe you don't have one, or maybe you just have a carport. Maybe you have to park on the street. And you go inside and get up the next morning and you go out, the car is gone. Or you're in a parking lot, like the fellow who's sitting next to me on an airplane telling me his story, and you're walking away from your car, and right after you walk away, the car is stolen. So what's going on? You know how for your credit cards all have those RFID signals. You got to be aware that having an RFID wallet is a good idea because criminals can steal that signal out of the air. Well, that same kind of idea is what car thieves are using. Instead of having to bash your window and all that, they're just intercepting your signal. So you can have your key in like a key box. You know, in our family, we walk inside, we drop our keys in the key box so we always remember where they are. Criminals are able to, in many cases, intercept those signals. And then next thing you know, your vehicle's gone, maybe never to be seen again.
So they're like outside in your driveway.
Outside in your driveway.
And they make a duplicate.
Right then and there. And they're gone with the wind. Yeah. So what does it cost to prevent this crime? Okay, it costs as little as $1. Or if you're one of those big Amazon spenders.
I was going to say $5.
No, Amazon people tend to spend $10.
Okay.
But if you shop around, you'll pay $1, $3, $5, whatever. For a key holder that blocks the signal from being intercepted. And I'd seen people using them. I didn't know why people were doing it. There were people who are a lot smarter than we are, Krista, who already knew this. But I've seen people with these little teeny fob pouches. And that's what they're for, is to prevent the signal. So when they get out of their vehicle, they put the key in their pouch, is in their pocket, or a woman in a purse. And they walk away and there's no signal for the criminal to intercept, duplicate your key, and be off. According to stuff I read from, it was one of the insurance regulatory groups or trade groups, that a criminal can duplicate in seconds, and in far less than a minute, they've already stolen your vehicle. And that's where these cheap pouches come into play. So if you just do a key fob pouch as a search, if you want to spend the Amazon money, you can do it there. But this is a simple way to prevent a nasty crime. So the gentleman next to me on the plane, told me his vehicle was ultimately recovered all the way across the country 4 months later.
Wow. Somebody had quite a joyride.
Yeah. 4 months worth.
That's crazy. All right. You want to go to questions?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay. Alex says, hello, Clark. I hear you rave about how beautiful Japan is and how inexpensive it is to visit. I was planning a trip out there with some friends after we graduate college, and we were wondering how you're able to make the trip decently cheap. We are willing to spend $5,000 each. We were using Expedia to help us search, but we're wondering if you had any other recommendations.
Okay, so first things first, Alex. The fares from the west coast of the U.S. to Japan are often a tiny fraction of what they are from the Midwest or the East Coast. I live on the East Coast, we flew a domestic flight, ultra cheap, to California, flew out of Los Angeles. The fare, including the positioning flight from the East Coast to Los Angeles, the total was 40% of what the fare was from the East Coast. So you cut your price 60% right away by buying two tickets, one to the West Coast and one on to Japan. Right now, and it changes all the time, of the big three West Coast gateways to Asia, which are L.A., San Francisco, and Seattle, right now, L.A. fares are cheaper to Japan than they are from Seattle or San Francisco. But that's just right now. You want to try all three. As far as hotel stays in Japan, Japan has every level of hotel imaginable, from you sleeping in a completely catastrophic, claustrophobic. It's catastrophically claustrophobic to sleep in a capsule hotel, which is literally like a big coffin that you stay in. Oh, my goodness. To some of the best luxury hotels in the world. They're all much cheaper than normal because of the decline in the value of the Japanese yen versus the U.S. dollar. In fact, everything felt so crazy affordable while we were in Japan. It was ridiculous. This is my fourth trip to Japan I just returned from. It was by far the least expensive of them. Public transit in Japan is crazy good. The subway lines in the big cities are safer than safe could be. The floors of the train cars and of the platforms are so clean, I would eat off the floors. They're so clean.
Wow.
No sense of crime anywhere. So using Expedia. Expedia, there have been so many customer no service complaints that I see posted everywhere about Expedia. I would be really cautious using Expedia. They have core customer no service issues clearly from everything being written about them. If you're thinking about flights, shop Google Flights or Hopper to find, and then go book direct with the airline you're going to fly on, or through a travel agent where you're dealing with an actual human agent. As far as logistics, I bought no tours, nothing like that. We just traveled around, but that's my travel style. We did as much or as little each day as we wanted to. You can buy a SIM when you get to Japan, a tourist SIM. They'll have a lot of data for like no money at all. 30 gig SIM. No, it was a 50 gig SIM, was $20 equivalent US. And that's way more than enough data for even a long trip to Japan. And it was super user-friendly and easy. Make sure on your iPhone or your Android before you go, you download Google Translate and preload Japanese on it. And it will deal with a world of issues you might have otherwise by being able to use Google Translate.
Awesome. And we have more information on booking hotels for a deal, not specifically to Japan, but we have a lot of travel information on Clark.com. But I'll quickly say my nephew just got back from Japan with his buddies on the cheap, so I'll have to ask him too. But if I'm going somewhere, I choose the cities I want to hit, and then you do research on hotels in the class that you're willing to stay in, you know, as cheaply as you want, and find maybe what the best ones are, and then use several sites to search and find the best deals, right?
I want to say something. Most Americans will go to Nara and Kyoto. Kyoto is intensely crowded, as I just experienced right now. It's being loved to death by tourists from around the world. It is a more difficult slog in Kyoto than normal. But we stayed in Osaka for half of our trip and used it as a base and used a Japan Rail Pass to go to Hiroshima, to go to Nara, to go to Kyoto, to go around. And we also did something I'd never done before in my three prior trips. We went to the other coast of Japan, the lightly populated side of Japan, and went to Kanazawa, which is a really fun area of Japan, probably good for a couple of day visit if you want to do something away from the normal East Coast corridor that Americans tend to go, Tokyo, Osaka, down to Hiroshima.
Awesome. Okay, Lucas in California says, I opened a TDF 2555 at Vanguard after Clark gave that advice. Right now, it's in my brokerage account, but I've read and heard that I should instead have it the TDF in a tax-advantaged account, like an IRA or Roth. Can you explain why and the advantages and disadvantages of doing this? Thanks for all the great info you put out there.
Thank you very much, Lucas. So a target retirement fund from any company should only be held inside a Roth or traditional IRA, 401k, or equivalent. You don't ever want it in a taxable brokerage account because the way a target retirement fund is set up, where the mix of investments is dynamic and continually changes over the years, you will suffer taxes that you have to pay over time. That what I would say, if you're building up money for the future, that's not necessarily for retirement with that target date for 31 years from now, what I would do is I'd put my money in a simple mix of broad market index funds, a total stock market index fund, which would be a U.S.-based international index fund for a portion of your money. Vanguard would say roughly 30% of your money should be in the international. And then maybe a bond index fund. And a mix of three funds would replicate in many ways a lot of what you'd have at a younger age, what would be in a target date fund. But there'd be no trading activity you'd have to worry about like you would inside a target date fund. So now the issue you face, if you were to sell your target date 2025 now, you're going to generate taxes by selling it to then put the money in the index funds I'm talking about. So it may be the best strategy is for you to hold what you have in the target date fund, but any future contributions in that brokerage account go into the broad index funds instead.
And Ashley in Michigan says, my son is 16 and just got his first job. How much of his paycheck do you recommend he place into a Roth, and who do you recommend for the Roth?
All of it in the Roth. As much as your 16-year-old, because you know your 16-year-old doesn't have rent or mortgage to pay, doesn't have all the normal expenses of an adult. So as much as they can save that they can pop into the Roth, I want them to do. And the reason is that money saved as a teen is powerful. Every dollar saved as a teen in a Roth is so much more valuable than a dollar put in someone's 20s or 30s or 40s and on like that, because of the compounding effect of time in the market. We were just talking about target date funds. Your 16-year-old could probably buy, I wonder if they go past 2065, 2070, whatever, as far out as you can buy, that would be what would be appropriate, Ashley, for your 16-year-old. And so the more your son is willing to save, the more value he's going to develop down the road. As far as where, I really like my three favorite children, obviously, for this, Fidelity, Schwab, or Vanguard. Vanguard tends to have the lowest cost, but the costs are so low on these target date funds with all three that it's going to be really cheap regardless.
And Vanguard does go through 2070.
2070, so that's good to know. So 2070 fund for your 16-year-old. And we're not going to be around when 2070 hits, but that money for your son who will be around will be a huge value. I didn't say you weren't going to be around, Ashley, but I'm not going to be
around. We don't
know
that.
2070. Come on, Krista. How old would I be in 2070?
I don't know.
I'd be older than Methuselah at that point, right?
Yeah, let's go for it, man.
That's not happening. But what is happening coming straight ahead, we're going to talk about why work from home is so exceedingly popular at a time that the number of postings for work from home are declining from employers. And that's making people looking for work from home more desperate and being more likely and susceptible to being taken in scams. I want to tell you what to watch for. So Krista and I argue about work from home because the number of legitimate work-from-home jobs so much higher, Krista, than they were pre-pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
But so much lower than they were a couple of years ago, as work has so heavily shifted back into offices. But we as humans suffer from what's known as recency bias. We get used to the way things have been of late. People got used to, and for so many people, it worked so much better for their lives being able to work from home, that now it's like people, that's what they want, and that's what they expect. The marketplace isn't generating enough job listings to deal with the greatly enhanced demand for people being able to work remotely. What we used to call work from home, now called remote work. And so criminals see opportunity. They see blood in the water. They're taking advantage. And so the scam activity with work at home or remote work listings is really, really, really ugly. So I want you to know key tip-offs. One of the areas that has been so frequent, and we've had questions about it repeatedly, is when you're asked, before you've even been through any kind of real meaningful screening for a job, you're asked for your Social Security number. You may even be asked for bank routing and transit numbers, account numbers, for them to deposit your paychecks to. When very early in a process, you're asked for social, and remember, your only connection may be through email or some kind of online chat or something like that. Who are you actually talking to? Are you talking to a real employer? You don't know. When they're asking you for that social really early, or even more deadly, they're asking for your transit numbers, what this is about almost always is flat out theft of funds, identity theft, and theft of your money. Because they probably by that point have your full name, they have your address, they've got all the key data once you've given your Social Security number, and even worse, you've given that transit number from the bottom of your check, supposedly for direct deposit of pay. Next thing you know is you're in this job search, you got no money, and somebody's applying for credit cards as if they're you. Be aware how common it is today, because of the fact that the interviews are also remote, that you have to be very, very cautious that you're dealing with a real employer and not a fake one. So if you are interviewing for a job with a company, maybe even a well-known and recognized company, and you're trying to figure out, is this job recruitment process legit? You go to the company's own website, go to their employment section, and you'll be able to see, do things match up or not? Are you dealing with the actual real company or not? It's so very common that you are getting scammed. And a lot of times, these crooks will pretend, oh, I'm an outside recruiter representing blah, blah, blah company. For a remote hire position, not for an executive level or high technical position, almost never would that be how it's working. So be very, very skeptical of the offer you're receiving. Also, if it is all legit, is it a good opportunity for you or a dead end? Like, what is the career track you'd be on? Is there one at all? Or is it just you're filling a role for as long or as short as they say? Are you going to be paid as an independent contractor? Are you responsible for all your own taxes, double Social Security and all that? Or are you being paid as an employee of this company? So just because you're looking to pick up work part-time often with remote work, or you're looking for a full-time opportunity, you've got to be aware of the 1-2 punch. One, the problems of the fraudulent posts of jobs. And unfortunately today, I'm going to be really terrible and say that most postings for remote work are bogus. Most are bogus. But if you get past the ones that are phony, is the job you're looking for that is legit, that's being offered, is it really a good opportunity for you? often if you're looking for something part-time, you may not be really processing these things. But I want you to think it through before you grab onto something that turns out not to be that great opportunity for you.
Speaking of that, a relevant question here from Julie in Georgia. I was looking for a job and found what I thought was a legitimate company that would allow me to work from home. Not so. It was a scam. I gave enough information for them to access my account. My bank is making me liable for $3,000 overdraft. I called the bank right away after I realized it was a scam, and they closed the old account and I opened a new one. What recourse do I have in regards to the bank making me liable for the $3,000?
So, Julie, I don't have enough information from you to know how they got into your account. If it was, as I mentioned just a moment ago, that you gave them the bank routing number and your account number information, you are not necessarily liable for that. If, on the other hand, they asked you for a code to access your account for online banking, then you may actually have difficulty reclaiming your funds. The banks, in every case, find against the consumer. It's automatic. It's like a bank mantra now that we hear repeatedly, that when there is a breach of someone's bank account, banks say, oh, well, you're just not covered in this case. That's standard banking 101 now. But you have rights under federal law. If you've not done so yet, I want you to file a complaint against the bank that holds you responsible for these $3,000 at consumerfinance.gov. That's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, whose very existence was under threat recently. The Supreme Court said that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was A-OK as constituted. And so they still have full enforcement power over the banks, which the banks were very upset about. But you file a complaint at consumerfinance.gov. Don't write too much detail. Just say there's been a breach of your account. This caused an overdraft of your account. And the bank is not relieving you responsibility for this. Just leave it at that. And let's see what happens next.
When do you think the consumer should be responsible?
The bank is not always responsible. I mean, it depends so much. This is the problem, is we could have 10,000 different scenarios mm-hmm. posed to us, and every one of them has different wrinkles. The banks just don't want to have to comply with the law, though.
Right. So you're getting an automatic answer.
Automatic no is what people are getting from the banks now, particularly as we're seeing repeatedly in our Team Clark Consumer Action Center, also in my TV work, we're seeing this as well, that no matter what the facts are, the banks say no.
All right.
And that's why, thank goodness, there's a consumer friend out there, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I'd love to hear back what happens, Julie. Mm-hmm.
Mary in Florida says, hi, Clark and staff. I was offered a new position with this company, and it's work from home. I'm very happy. However, while signing all the paperwork, there was a statement that I would need to keep my webcam on for the full duration of my work. I understand training that we need them on. However, it feels weird having this company constantly watching me. And yes, I get it if I was in an office setting that's the norm, but at home, I don't want to have my camera on. It's not Hollywood. Thanks for your feedback.
So a lot of employers don't trust that somebody doing remote work is actually working. So they're using a variety of spy tools, and just having your webcam on is actually pretty mild compared to a lot of the spy tools that companies require of remote workers.
You think? I feel like that's more. I mean, there's screen recording, which makes sense, like to see that you're on the work screens and you're not like playing on Facebook all day.
There's also productivity software that a lot of companies are using.
But like having a camera on you all day?
I'm so used to being on camera, I guess it doesn't even faze me.
That would be the one that bothered me the most, because if I'm really being productive and getting my work done, I don't know, it'd just be a little weird.
This goes back to the terms of employment that I was just kind of alluding to earlier. And it may make, if it really bothers you, Mary, as much as it seems to bother you, Krista, then that may not be the remote work for you. But having companies spying on you different ways if you're working remotely is totally routine now in industry.
Lori in Arkansas says, I called my credit card company to hopefully settle on a lower amount to completely pay it off, and I was told I couldn't bargain with them because I was not in default. Should I stop paying them for a couple of months and risk our credit for them to work with me? It's at $12,000 now, and the interest has been a hardship.
So, Lori, no. The one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to just default on your credit card debt, because that will harm you for 7 years. At the same time, you're making clear that the interest carry cost on your credit card is brutal for you. What I would do if I were you is what the people at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling have always asked, that people go and talk to them when they're feeling like they have a fever and not wait till it's a terminal condition with debt. So if you go to nfcc.org or one of their affiliate members, they're legitimate credit counselors. They'll sit down with you, Lori, and not just look in isolation at this $12,000 debt with this one credit card company. They'll want to look at your whole financial picture and see if you simply need the help of thinking through how to come up with a budget that makes handling your money more efficient, or they can negotiate a payment plan with this credit card company, even reducing the interest rate down to as little as 0%. So the credit card companies listen to the trained professionals of NFCC or NFCC affiliated agencies, because they know they've looked at your whole finances and they know the next possibility could be somebody potentially bankrupting out, where the credit card company gets nothing. And so that would be the right process. And it may be that NFCC or affiliate counselor works with you either in person or virtually and says, you know, you can handle this. Here's what you need to do to get it done. Or they may say, nope, I see where you're coming from, and we're going to see what we can negotiate for you. Either would be vastly superior to you doing what basically is, gosh, it's the nuclear option, stopping paying your bills so that they'll then work with you to try to reduce what you owe or your interest rates, because that will then follow you. 7 years is a long time. We're talking 2031. That decision would follow you till then. I don't want that for you. But I do want to tell you, I really am thrilled that you came to ask me that question. I hope that talking to someone with NFCC.org or one of their affiliates will help you get it done, to get that under control. And I hope that you have a wonderful day, and we will be at your service tomorrow on our podcast. And remember what we're all about. It's helping you come up with ideas and ways to save more, spend less, and avoid getting ripped off.